This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, November 12, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The saber rattling is getting louder at the top echelons of the Bush administration. The president issued a tough new warning to Saddam Hussein yesterday as administration officials said that a war could begin before the end of the year. In a series of Veterans Day memorial services, Bush said he was ready to take his country to war. Unless President Saddam Hussein fully disarmed, said Bush, America will lead a coalition to fully disarm him. Bush said, I have no greater responsibility than protecting the American people. Should military action become necessary for our own security, I will commit the full force and might of the United States military, and we will prevail. Speaking at a forum hosted by Fortune magazine in Washington Monday, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld took questions from members of the audience who paid $5,000 a plate to hear him speak.
Mr. Secretary, my name's Dan Yergin. I wonder, when you look 2 or 3 years down the road, do you have a picture in your mind as to how the war on terrorism comes to an end and what the end looks like?
On the assumption that human nature is not going to change dramatically in that period of time, one has to assume that there will be people who will be teaching the kind of thing that's being taught in too many madrasas and too many locations around the world. That there will still be people who will be looking for ways to damage the West, the United States, and free people. Can we live in that world? Yes, we can. We can find ways to live in the world. We have a lot of vulnerabilities. We have a terrific Army and a terrific Navy and terrific Air Force. But if one thinks about it, the terrorist networks don't have armies, navies, or air forces. What they do is they look for weaknesses. And clearly, a terrorist can attack at any time, any place, using any technique, and it's physically not possible to defend it every time, in every place, against every technique. So we want to be able to get up in the morning and go out of our house without looking to the right and the left to see if someone's going to shoot us. We want to be able to send our kids off to school and know they're going to come home safely. And we want to have sufficient certainty that we can have the kinds of investments and the kinds of business climate and the thing that underlies successful commerce in this world is security and a relatively peaceful world. That is central. I think we can live in the world. Does that mean it'll ultimately end at some point? I think we will eventually sufficiently damage the so-called Al-Qaeda terrorist network that it will not be able to function. But there are many other terrorist networks, and people will form new groups.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. One had to listen carefully and read between the lines during his lengthy response, only to learn that the administration believes the war could be never-ending. Iraq's parliament declared by unanimous consent today that President Saddam Hussein reject the UN resolution to allow weapons inspectors access to all government sites. He has until Friday to decide. Tariq Al-Mazrem is a spokesman for the Kuwaiti embassy. We spoke with him Friday after the UN vote. He reiterated Kuwait's longtime alliance with the U.S.
Tariq, what's your initial reaction to the UN resolution that was just passed today, allowing the Bush administration to actually at some point have the authority to wage war against Iraq?
Well, our initial action as in Kuwait, we always from the beginning, we were talking about to have the UN to be involved in anything in future with Iraq, because Verna, if we go back to Kuwait, Kuwait was occupied by Iraq in 1990 and was liberated under the auspices of the UN Security Council resolution. So by having Kuwait, we liberated by this UN organized. So we believe that having UN be involved is very important.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kuwait had said all along that it would wait for a UN resolution before agreeing to let the U.S. launch from its territory. Does today's agreement mean basically that Kuwait is prepared to provide its territory for the U.S. to wage war against the people of Iraq?
It's not a matter, Verna, of having Kuwait territory to be used against the people of Iraq. The thing we go back, UN, as a UN mandate, as a Kuwait member of the UN organization, the, and as Kuwait was liberated by the UN mandate, it's very important to have Kuwait be, to have the UN involved in any future crisis with Iraq. We support the UN resolution. America is our ally. America has liberated our country. And the poll here, it's not in Kuwait's side. It's in the Iraqi regime side. If he wants to prevent war, if he wants to stop everybody talking about war, actually, he's the one who has to work on it. Everybody, we are asking him, please, it's just basically if you're on resolution, comply with it. If you have nothing to hide, it comply with it. And let's relax the religion. Let's keep going in our life. Stop hijacking the region. Every 2 or 3 years, you provoked something, and oh, let me go to the Arab streets; they will cover me. No, this has to stop.
How do the people of Kuwait generally feel about the U.S. launching a new war against Iraq and about the continuation of the economic sanctions, which, of course, were led by the UN's own estimate? Or, of course, which were led by the UN and by its own estimate is causing the deaths of 5,000 children a month.
Well, Werner, it's not only in the Arab and Kuwait street. Everybody is sympathizing with the Iraqi people. Everybody. Nobody. Even here in the state. Everybody is sympathizing with the people. The people, they are the victim of their regime. And that's what we think that... In Kuwait, we are not, I mean, like any other country in the world. I mean, everybody is sympathizing with the Iraqi people. We would love to have them a good future, and we would love to have them, like any democracy coming in the region, like what you see in Bahrain and Qatar. In Kuwait, we have a parliament. And like any open society, there is no censorship in Kuwait in newspaper. People either endorse the war, or they are talking about, or they have their own reservation. It's people is debating the issue with regard to the Iraqi dilemma, the Iraqi people. We really sympathize with them.
So would it be fair to say that the majority of the Kuwaiti people don't want to attack Iraq?
No, I can't say that because there is no certain polling in Kuwait. But what I'm telling you is two things. The government is endorsing the UN resolution because Kuwait is a member of the UN resolution, and Kuwait was liberated by the UN resolution. About the people of Kuwait, like I can't tell you that, like, because sometimes we feel insecurity for the last 11 years. You can see the Iraqi regime every year still celebrating the invasion of Kuwait, still celebrating the Kuwait when they annex Kuwait and trying to take erase us from the history. So that creates fear inside the Kuwaiti people, is creating insecurity in Kuwait people. So then you have the debate in Kuwait. The debate in Kuwait, I mean, it's like any debate in any other world. So you would find, maybe you could say majority, they are seeing the war in a different view, or some. But it's like in any open society.
Is Kuwait fearful of Saddam Hussein?
Of course, that
he poses a threat to Kuwait?
Of course. Werner, let me put it this way. I mean, this guy, he invaded Kuwait with completely unprovoked action.
Tarek Al-Mezrem is a spokesman for the Kuwaiti embassy. Steve Pelletier, author of Iraq and the International Oil System, says the Kuwaiti official is oversimplifying the matter.
It's too simplistic. The representative knows very well that what the Iraqis are afraid of is the United States will get in there and will provoke an incident and will use that as an excuse for going to war. The last time the inspectors were in there, the United States infiltrated the inspection team with Central Intelligence, or I don't know whether it was Central Intelligence or Defense Intelligence spies, and the Iraqis never gotten over that. It was a shock. So as a consequence, there isn't the kind of trust on the Iraqi side that he's implying, that all the Iraqis have to do is let the inspection team in and the team won't find anything and that'll be the end of it. What the Iraqis are worried about is the United States has no intention of getting this thing over without toppling the regime. And the inspection team, once it's inside, will provide some sort of provocation for an American attack.
Well, what is your reaction to his statement about how the people of Kuwait feel? He says they feel very insecure with President Saddam Hussein remaining in power. He says, of course, this man has attacked them.
It's more than he's letting on. The fact of the matter is that the Baathists, they're the ones that rule Iraq, have a long history going way back of antagonism for the oil sheikhs in the lower Gulf. The ideology of Baath looks on those sheikhs as drones, as regimes in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and elsewhere. In the eyes of a good Baathist, are retrogressive. They see no reason why all this oil wealth should be in the hands of a few sheikhs. So there's almost a visceral dislike on the part of the Baathists for the sheikhs. And of course, the sheikhs have every reason to fear a regime or an ideology, whichever way you want to put it, that looks on them with contempt.
Do you see Saddam Hussein as the threat to the region that the spokesman for the embassy does?
No, I don't think. I think that the Iraqis have been so beaten around the head and shoulders for so long, and there's such miserable condition now that they can't threaten anyone. I think that let me comment on his statement that it was an unprovoked war. It wasn't, again, it was not that simple. The Iraqis had just fought an 8-year war against the Iranians, and it was fought at tremendous cost in human lives, we know that. But it also was at a tremendous financial cost. At the end of the war, the Iraqis were deeply, deeply into debt. And in order to climb out of debt, they only had one thing to depend upon, and that was the sale of their oil. And at that juncture, Kuwait and the UAE were, quote, cheating on their oil quota. All three are members of OPEC, but two of them, Kuwait and UAE, were cheating on their quota, producing more oil than they were entitled to. And as a consequence, the price was being forced down because there was a developing glut on the market. The Iraqis told them to stop cheating, and they ignored it. And as a consequence, the exchange between Iraq and the Kuwaitis developed into an escalating game of chicken in which the Kuwaitis simply went too far. They assumed, I assume, that the United States was in their corner, and therefore Iraq wouldn't dare attack them, and they miscalculated.
And, of course, we recall that there was some back and forth between U.S. official April Glaspie as to whether or not the U.S. would then attack Iraq for having attacked Kuwait.
Yeah, even that is confused in the public's mind. April was called on the spur of the moment to go and talk to Saddam. No one had ever been granted an interview with Saddam, none of the diplomatic corps. She had to go at a moment's notice. From every indication, she wasn't briefed. She really did not know what Washington wanted her to tell him. And so when she got in there, she just fed him the line. And the line was that the United States does not interfere in the activities of other nations, and Kuwait is independent, and Iraq is independent, and you can do whatever you want to. We're staying out of this. Well, the Iraqis knew that that was nonsense. Kuwait is constantly looking to the United States for guidance, and if the United States said to Kuwait, look, stop cheating, give the man his money, they'd have done it. So when Glaspie told Saddam, we're not going to interfere with this, that was not the answer he was looking for. He was looking for some assurance that we would do something, and when we didn't, the escalation between Kuwait and Iraq just kept on until it boiled over.
And so what did the U.S. stand to gain from Kuwait cheating Iraq out of oil?
Stood to gain a great deal. You see, the United States needs to keep the price of oil down. We need it because you saw what happens when the price of oil goes up. You saw the inflation that it causes worldwide, and you saw the effect that it has here in the United States. We were cooperating for many years with the Saudis and the Kuwaitis to keep the price of oil low. In OPEC, there is a coterie of so-called OPEC hawks, the Iraqis, the Iranians, and the Venezuelans. And these states do not want the price low. They want the price high. And therefore, at every juncture, they attempt to drive it up, and the sheikhs attempt to push it down. Well, in pushing it down, they are benefiting the United States. When the Kuwaitis and the UAE were cheating on their quota, the price was low because there was so much oil on the market, and as a consequence, we were very happy. So we would have been perfectly happy to have that situation go on with a low price of oil, and that was extremely short-sighted.
And of course, if and when the Bush administration invades Iraq, it will have control of
Exactly.
Oil. Steve Pelletier is author of Iraq and the International Oil System. As part of their campaign to convince the world that a war against Iraq is necessary, members of the Bush administration often repeat the claim that Iraq is a threat to its neighbors in the Persian Gulf. We raised that issue in a recent discussion with Edmund Garib, professor of Kurdish studies at American University in Washington, D.C., and here's his response.
What we're seeing now, while the U.S. Government and administration keeps emphasizing that there is a threat to Iraq, from Iraq to the neighborhood. Arab leaders friendly to the U.S. have complained that the U.S. doesn't consult them but dictates to them. They have also, they are all saying basically that they would prefer that the U.S. not use force. They are very much opposed to the use of force against Iraq. They are opposed to the invasion of Iraq. And they feel that this would be threatening to the whole security and would encourage Islamist radicals. These governments basically are opposed, but not because they like Saddam Hussein's regime, but they are opposed because of security issues, because of the impact of war on the stability in the region, and because it will foster radicalism. On the other hand, there is a even a stronger reaction from the public. There is, and this is what's interesting about this, is that you're getting opposition from liberals, from Islamists, as well as from nationalists, who are very critical of the U.S. Position on Iraq. For example, the liberal intellectuals join those who argue that the U.S. is not living up to its ideals in the Middle East. They said the U.S. doesn't practice what it preaches. They hear talk about human rights, but they say the U.S. does not stand by them when it comes to Arabs or Muslims. And to them, this is, in a way, they see that the U.S. is not identifying with the aspirations of the people for human rights, for a democratic society, for liberty, and that the U.S. has been historically supportive of authoritarian or dictatorial regime. To the nationalists, the U.S., they see it more and more as playing an imperialistic role, and they say that the interest appears to be hegemony, it appears to be control of the region's resources, and already they are referring to this talk of dividing the spoils of Iraqi oil even before the country is occupied. They are also very much concerned because they see a lot of double standards when it applies, for example, on the one hand to Israel or strong countries or friendly countries to the United States, or to a weak country that is Iraq. And the final thing that I think is very interesting also is that people see the situation different today from when they saw it in 1990. In 1990-91, there was a sort of some division within Arab public opinion and certainly among the governments, which basically led to people saying, well, Iraq violated international law, it violated the charter of the Arab League, and it was an aggressor when it invaded Kuwait. But now they see, in fact, Iraq not as an aggressor, but as a victim, as a defenseless victim. And this is changing the attitude. Mm-hmm. And one final point, I think that's very important, that makes the difference, and I think has helped change attitudes also, and is the role that the new media in the Arab world is playing, the new satellite channels, the pan-Arab media, and to a certain extent even media like the BBC and Monte Carlo, but channels such as Al Jazeera, such as Nilesat, such as Abu Dhabi, such as Arab News Network, these are bringing pictures of what's happening in Palestine as well as in Iraq Almost everybody who has a dish can get these pictures, and this is influencing public opinion.
You spoke of fostering radicalism among the neighbors in the region. What kind of impact or what kind of effect do you think that's going to have in that region if and when the U.S. does go to war against Iraq?
Nobody knows for sure what kind of an impact it's going to have. But one thing is certain. I think that this is certainly going likely to create more antagonism, more hostility in the region. One of the things is that we're likely to see is that people are going to begin to see this, that in fact the West, the United States, are targeting Muslims and are targeting Arabs, and in this sense they are playing into the hands of radical Islamists like Osama bin Laden and others like him. In fact, that be probably we might see the mushrooming of new groups, new organizations, and some people will act on their own, like we've been seeing recently in few incidents here and there, which are targeting either American business or American military people or individuals or their diplomat, as we saw in Jordan. This is going to lead to increasing perception that this is almost a civilizational war or a religious war, and hopefully this would not be the result, but this is one of the concerns that a lot of people in the region had.
Edmund Garib is a professor of Kurdish studies at American University. Anthrax and its potential as a weapon of mass destruction was discussed last week by retired Major Sonny Bates, a U.S. Air Force veteran who documents research on the effect of the anti-anthrax vaccine on his colleagues, all of whom were U.S. Air Force pilots.
The military gave me a lot of responsibility and a lot of opportunity, and I savored every moment of it. I wasn't a troublemaker, and I fit very well in the system. But that all ended in August of 1999. In August of 1999, I was stationed at Dover Air Force Base. I was being requalified in the C-5 Galaxy, and I started hearing people discuss their ailments. As I was walking down the hall, you could see people sick, walking slowly, holding their head. They looked like they should be in a rest home. And these people were late 20s, mid-30s. And then I would hear them talking about not flying, and finally I just started asking questions. I said, what's wrong with you? And, for example, Michelle, she told me, she said, well, I haven't flown in 9 months, and I was perfectly healthy before I took the anthrax vaccine, and now I can't do anything. I can't read a book. I can't remember to do the common things that I used to do every day. I have blackouts. I have vertigo, and I have an autoimmune disorder. And I felt really bad for her, and I thought, well, you know, she mentioned something about an anthrax vaccine, but, you know, I was like everybody else. The more vaccines, the better. They're like vitamins. They make me stronger. They make me tougher. I can go do anything the more vaccines I have. So I went to my training, and my training partner in the simulator said that he had been sick for a long time and couldn't fly. I said, what's wrong? He said, well, I was healthy before I took the anthrax vaccine. I said, well, wait a minute. And he said, it's not all. My wife has been sick since I took the anthrax vaccine, too. And we took her to a doctor and did a blood test on her, and she had anthrax in her blood. I started getting real interested then. I went to lunch the same day after talking to my training partner, and I met an old friend of mine at Burger King. Darren, how you doing? He said, I haven't flown in 9 months. I said, let me guess. He goes, what? I said, the anthrax vaccine. He goes, yeah, I was perfectly healthy until I took the anthrax vaccine. I went back to my squadron. I talked to the scheduler, and I said, how many people do we have sick? He said, well, it's really hard to say, but there's 12 people hard out. They can't do their job. And there's the list of them there. There's many of them that are still sick and still flying. I said, why would they fly when they're sick? Because we've always been trained not to do that. It's dangerous. He said they're afraid to speak up. In fact, the people that are sick have been told they're not allowed to talk about it because they'll be punished. So I took the names of these people that were sick. I went home that night, talked it over with my wife. I said, I'm going to call these people, see what's going on here. 12 people I called that night, same story. I was healthy. I was an athlete. I could run miles and miles. No one could stop me. I was great until I took the anthrax vaccine. Now I can't even work a power drill. I can't ride my motorcycle anymore. I can't wash my car. Chronic fatigue, autoimmune disorders. The list went on and on and on. But they all had one thing in common. They were healthy, and then they took the anthrax vaccine, and now they couldn't do their job. So I went the next day and talked to my commander. I said, I think we have a problem. He shut the door. I told him what I found, and he said that 2 months before I had arrived at the base, the wing commander, Colonel Felix Greeter, was confronted with people all over the base that were having illnesses from the vaccine. And the medical community was not answering their questions. He spoke, the commander did, the wing commander, to the medical community and tried to get questions answered. They were not answered, and he suspended the program. The Pentagon came to our base within 2 days after he suspended the program and reinstituted the program. Within weeks, that commander was replaced, not promoted like the previous commanders, and he was put into a lateral at best job in the Pentagon where he could be watched under close quarters by the other leaders that were above him. My commander went on to explain that he had the air and the water tested in the squadron, and they were both good, and that he did not know what was causing the problems, but we had a problem. He asked me to research the anthrax vaccine and to get back with him on anything I found out. So I did. What I found out was shocking. First of all, I looked at the vaccine itself. What is it? How's it made? Used the internet primarily. I went to the FDA's websites and other websites by our government. And I found that the FDA had not, and this was written by the Government Accounting Office, the inspectors for our Congress, the company that makes the anthrax vaccine went 23 years without being inspected. Right away, the big warning flag came up. In 1993, Bioport, the company that manufactured the product, was inspected, probably due to Gulf War illness issues and the question of, did this vaccine cause Gulf War illness? When the inspectors arrived at Bioport, then called Michigan MBPI, a state-owned company by Michigan, it later changed names to Bioport, they found that the company was producing a vaccine in an unlicensed way. The filters being used were allowing contaminants through and higher levels and actually inconsistent levels of antigen in the vaccine. The antigen levels were varying from 0 to 100. So one soldier is getting a shot with little antigen, another soldier is getting a shot with 100 times that much. They had filtration system problems in the way that the wrong materials were being used, the wrong materials for the filtration. They had handling problems. Some of the product was not being refrigerated the way it should be or stored the way it should be. They had labeling problems to the point where the FDA inspectors found that Bioport, or the employees there at that time under a different name, had removed the labels off the vaccine that had expired with alcohol and put new labels on as if it was a new vaccine. Highly immoral, highly unethical, highly illegal. No one was sentenced, no one was charged, no one was put in jail. No one recalled the product. No one destroyed the product. That's an adulterated product by FDA's own standards. Other things I found out about the vaccine when I researched it was that it had questionable origin. This company in Michigan was not the only company under contract to produce the vaccine. The other companies that are on contract included PRI out of Maryland, working out of the National Cancer Institute. The money trail's there, the documentation's there. I showed it to the Pentagon. They just shook their head and said it didn't happen. Then you got to ask yourself, how can some of these soldiers have antibodies to squalene in their blood when Bioport said, we never put squalene in it, but then later on the FDA did find squalene in the vaccine. That's because the documentation I found is PRI was supposed to manufacture this product, ship it in bulk to Bioport into Michigan to be bottled and labeled. You would never know where the product came from. It looked like it came from Michigan when it didn't. It looked like it had Michigan's products in it, or ingredients, and it didn't. So here we were working with a questionable product at best. Other things I found out about the anthrax vaccine when I looked into it was the ownership of the company itself. Maybe not anything to do with the ingredients, but it has something to do with the questions you might ask yourself of why does our government and our leadership continue to seem to push forward on things and not stop and listen to the questions. That's because I believe that there's too many high-power individuals up in government that have financial stakes tied to programs. Retired Admiral Crowell is part owner of Bioport. That may have nothing to do with this, but I think those with common sense would say it may very well have something to do with this.
Retired U.S. Air Force Major Sonny Bates speaking on C-SPAN last week about the effects of the anti-anthrax vaccine. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown.